Welcome to WCLK's The Local Take with Kiplin Primus. Join Kiplin right now as she talks with leaders, activists, and everyday people making a difference in the Atlanta community.
This month, in celebration of Black History, I reached out to Ambassador Andrew Young to speak about our past, our current, and our future conditions. I asked Andrew Young to share with us some anecdotes about his comrades. So, Ambassador Young, welcome back to The Local Take.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. And it's always good to talk to my friends at WCLK.
Well, I wanted to talk about some of the folks that we recently lost. Could you share with us an anecdote about C.T. Vivian?
Well, one of the things that very few people know is that the sit-ins started in North Carolina in 1960. The Montgomery bus boycott was in 1955 in Montgomery. But C.T. Vivian started sit-ins in Peoria, Illinois, in 1947.
Wow.
So he was almost a decade ahead of the rest of us. And he was a student of nonviolence who accepted a job at the Baptist Convention Seminary there in Nashville. And that's where he hooked up and became one of the mentors of John Lewis and Bernard Lafayette and James Bevel and Diane Nash. And one of the best movements, I think, in the country came from Nashville, because they actually studied nonviolence for almost 6 months before they started demonstrating. And they had 6 o'clock in the morning discussions nobody who was serious could say they were busy. And they stuck together, they worked together, and they developed a battle plan before they started the sit-ins. And that's the reason they were so successful.
So there was strategy behind what they were doing. It wasn't happenstance.
No, there was strategy, but I remember James Bevel saying that, and this was typical of Bevel, he said he went to the library at Fisk, and there were a lot of books on Gandhi, and they were all very dusty, and it was obvious that nobody had been reading them. So he said he put them all in a box and walked out of the library, and they said, where are you going? He said, I'm taking these books to somebody that will read them and do something with them. and they really did study and discuss and make plans that were specific for Nashville as a result of the background they got from Gandhi, first in South Africa and then in the liberation of the entire Indian subcontinent from the British without killing anybody.
Can you tell us an anecdote about Reverend Joseph Lowry?
Yeah, Reverend Lowry was the chairman and one of the few Methodists that signed up with Martin Luther King in New Orleans in 1957 when they founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And he was elected the chairman of the board. And so he was right there with Dr. King and Reverend Abernathy and 100 ministers from across the South that founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1957 in New Orleans. He moved to Atlanta. He was pastoring in Mobile and was the leader of the bus boycott in Mobile, Alabama. And in the Methodist Church, your bishop can transfer you And so they transferred him from Mobile to Huntsville. Yeah, so he was pastoring in Huntsville. And he was also with us on the march from Selma to Montgomery. But his job was to go to visit Governor Wallace and take the proclamation that we were marching with. He was the one that took it personally to Governor Wallace in the state capitol. He also became the head of SCLC after Dr. King's death, and he did some very interesting things with gun buybacks. His wife, Evelyn, was equally as activist, and she organized SCLC women and arranged to buy a building right down there next to SCLC on Auburn Avenue. And she was probably the first one to start in terms of health care and AIDS recognition and awareness. She and her children, three daughters, they were a movement family and still are. In fact, they're there on the Clark AU campus running the Joseph E. Lowery Institute, training young people at Clark College now in how to activate a movement in their communities on the campus and preparing them to continue the movement on into the future.
They're called change agents, yes.
Yeah.
And now, can you tell us something about Hank Aaron?
Well, I tell you, Hank Aaron grew up right outside Mobile. And the story that he told all the time was that his mother would come, and he knew whenever his mother called him, he should stop whatever he was doing and come directly. And so she came out on the front porch, and he was over across in the park in the a vacant lot playing baseball. And she said, "Henry, get in here right now! Hurry up!" And they all left the game and came. And she said, "Get under the bed! Get under the bed!" And they knew when that the reason for that was she had heard that the Ku Klux Klan was coming down the road and didn't want them to be out there to be seen publicly lest something happened to them. And said as soon as they went on by, she called them out and said, "Okay, you go back out and play now." But he grew up very much aware of the horror and terror of race relations. And yet he never got excited about it. He never lost his cool. He was one of that generation that I'm proud to be a part of and that Jackie Robinson symbolized with Hank Aaron. And that is, you don't get mad. You get smart. And one of the things about the leaders who desegregated baseball. And baseball organized, the major leagues desegregated before President Truman desegregated the military. And when they were desegregated, they didn't just desegregate the northern teams, but Hank Aaron played baseball all across the South, Jacksonville, Savannah. He had played those cities in the old Negro leagues, but this was playing in an integrated league where usually he was one of the only, one of no more than two or three African-American ballplayers. So there was a lot of pressure on him, and he couldn't stay in the hotels with the other players, but they usually arranged for some of the prominent people in the community who had extra rooms were only too glad to have him as as a guest. In fact, during the 40s and 50s, I guess everybody kind of stayed that way when they were going from town to town. You had to stop where you knew somebody, where they'd let you sleep on the couch or on the floor, because mm-hmm. there were no hotels that were available to us.
It's an amazing journey that your generation went through. And I'm going to ask again about our favorite, John Lewis.
Yeah.
If you could just share another story about John Lewis, and do you think we're going to get the John Lewis Voting Rights Act passed?
Well, I think we must get the John Lewis Voting Rights Act passed. And I think that what's going on now on television, the second impeachment of Donald Trump, is documenting so clearly all of his attempts at perpetuating election fraud and trying to get the Congress and the Senate to steal, and the state legislatures to steal the election, that they're not, I don't know whether they'll impeach him or not, or what they'll do for him, but America is getting a good education on the need for voting rights. And I would suspect that not only would the John Lewis Voting Rights Act pass, but there's a tradition in the Congress that each state has two statues of heroes from their state. And nobody's particularly aware of who the hero was. It was somebody from the old Confederacy. But there is an effort underway to put John Lewis' statue in the Statuary Hall of the Capitol. And I think that will probably take place. Hopefully the two of them could take place together.
This is Kiplin Primus, your host for The Local Take. For Black History Month this year, I sat down and spoke with Ambassador Andrew Young. Here's the rest of our conversation. You know, Georgia turned blue again, I guess I should say, and several leaders in our community have become prominently on a national stage. Stacey Abrams, Keisha Lance Bottom, and our new senator, Raphael Warnock. Can you tell us what you think about these new leaders that are taking Georgia, sometimes kicking and screaming, into the future?
Well, you know, Georgia's been, this is second or third time we've been through this. Georgia was very influential. And it was Hank Aaron that was one of the sponsors of a voter rally over in DeKalb County that invited Bill Clinton down here. And we had 25,000 people in that stadium over there in DeKalb. And Bill Clinton won Georgia by 11,000 votes. And so whenever we have come together and voted, the same thing was true with Jimmy Carter. We not only carried Georgia, but we carried most of the South with Jimmy Carter as a candidate. And Georgia has always had the potential of being a Democratic state. Well, let me put it this way. Georgia will vote for the best man or woman. Nationally, they have never believed this. And it was an accident that Bill Clinton, because of his friendship with Hank Aaron, decided to come when everybody up north wanted him to go to Michigan or somewhere else and ignore Georgia. But if he hadn't come to Georgia, he wouldn't have been the president.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been true on a number of occasions. Georgia has been there for those who work it. And nobody has worked it any better than Stacey Abrams. And she did it for her own campaign, but she did it even better for this last election. But we had a significant help financially from the Democratic Party nationally. But for instance, in Barack Obama's case, we raised almost $10 million from Georgia and sent it to Washington, but they didn't even let Barack Obama come to, to Georgia to campaign. They just wrote Georgia off. And I think that was one of the mistakes that Hillary Clinton made, writing Georgia off. And this time we had the high ground. And it was clear that these two young men were head and shoulders above the others. And it just, well, it was interesting that one of them happened to be black and the other one happened to be Jewish. And I think the fact that John Lewis had helped to organize a black-Jewish coalition 25 or 30 years ago, and we had worked with the Jewish community even back in 72 when I was elected. And even though my opponent was Jewish when I ran for mayor in 1982, I think I got the majority of the Jewish vote. The combination of the liberal community, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, that's now emerging around, you know, the old city of Atlanta. Gwinnett County is now majority multinational. And I don't know what the county is there now, but Carolyn Bardot, who's a professor at Georgia State, won that congressional district. And she happens to be white, but she is the most liberal and activist candidate running. And everybody, you know, gathered around behind her. So it's Atlanta, remember, in the 60s, well, in 1960, just before I came to it, I got here in 1961, but 1960, there was a $4 million campaign put on by the business community to be a city too busy to hate. And it was, well, Mayor Hartsfield wanted to build an airport. And he invited Delta over here and offered them land for 50 years at $1 a year. He started planning for an airport runway and bought that land out there for $90,000. And then he put up red lights on Peachtree Street and they voted him out of office. And the business community decided that there just were not enough progressive white people in the city to move the city forward as fast as we needed to go. And they went over to AU and Clark and Spelman and Morehouse were all very active with the Chamber of Commerce. And they put together a black and white coalition, a coalition of goodwill, we called it. None of the, I mean, not Mayor Hartsfield, never got the majority of the white vote. Ivan Allen, who was from the Chamber of Commerce and had a series of businesses across the state, couldn't get the majority of the white vote. But there was a coalition of black and white voters that has moved this city forward and moved the state forward, because we've been pretty much together in our thinking, and it hasn't been about, you know, who's going to win so much as what's best for the city, what's best for the state. And when we think that way, we come through, and we don't always win in a landslide, but when people see the leadership united, they get behind us and we win. Now the challenge is to win in the Congress. Mm-hmm. And We didn't have a landslide victory. Warnock and Ossoff just made it 50 Democrats against 50 Republicans. And Kamala Harris, as the vice president, will be the tiebreaker in the Senate. But we still have a lot of work to do.
Well, I don't think they'll ever take Georgia for granted again. I don't think there's a way that you can do that, you know, moving forward.
You know, we can get a little too cocky and sure of ourselves. It's not automatic. I mean, every congressman that is holding a seat right now is going to be up for election in a couple of years. And they'll be challenged. And the thing is, they'll be challenged probably by Black Republicans.
It'll get more complicated, so to speak.
It's going to be, I mean, this is one of the fastest growing states in the world. And we complain about what's wrong with it. But there's a whole lot right with Atlanta. And when we stop and take advantage of the fact that there is so much right. I mean, the presence of Clark and Morehouse and Spelman and Morris Brown and the Interdenominational Theological Center, just their presence here for the last 150 years has given us a base of really good school teachers, really good doctors and nurses. I mean, we have young, educated businessmen, because when Maynard and I became mayor, him first and me second, he wouldn't do anything in the city unless 25% of every contract went to a minority-owned company. And I raised it first to 35% and then to 40%. And Kasim raised it to 50%. And that's why we have so many people buying nice houses. They're probably dressing up a little too much and maybe eating too much also. But this is a good city, and I've lived up all over the world. And I'll always come back home to Atlanta, even though I wasn't born here. I was born in New Orleans.
But Atlanta is definitely home.
Atlanta's home.
You mentioned young leaders, and I know that you are working with some young leaders in our community, and you guys are opening a bank, Greenwood Bank. Can you tell us who are those leaders that you're working with and how this idea of the bank came about?
Well, it was a group that started, I guess, about 5 or 6 years ago. They started Bounce TV, and the idea was that they would have a national network that poor people could get Black programming without having to pay for cable. And Bounce TV, you could go to Radio Shack and you could buy a little antenna for $29, or sometimes as low as $19. And you could get Bounce TV, and they featured high-class Black programming, and they had an audience that was nationwide. Unfortunately, they didn't own the majority of it, because that's when the idea of a Black bank started, that they were going to take this network of communication and began to use it as a marketing mechanism. Some of them are... Well, it was Ryan Glover who was sort of his idea, and my son was sort of with him. And what I do with them is what I did with them. I served as a kind of honorary chairman. I wasn't a part of the day-by-day decision-making, but if they were trying to get into, well, I remember they were trying to get into Philadelphia. I helped them get into Philadelphia. Well, I might not have done any more for another month, but this is not my project. This is a project of a younger generation in their 40s that I don't know where they got their money from, but they didn't get any of it from me. Because one of the problems we had in the civil rights movement was, and as mayor, you couldn't make money in politics. And the mayor's salary, when I was mayor, is lower than, I mean, the sanitation workers right now make more than I made as a mayor. And I didn't get a pension because I wasn't there 14 years. See, these are young people. There's another young fellow who went to Morehouse and Georgia Tech, ended up getting a PhD at Georgia Tech in cybersecurity. And he's been working as a consultant for all of the major banks. And now he's putting his imprint on his own Greenwood Bank. Killer Mike happened to have been the president of the mayor's youth council when I was mayor, and he was 15 years old. To see him grow up and develop into quite a businessman and entertainer. And he's a part of that group. And I can see differences in Atlanta since I was mayor. I mean, for instance, if you just take a look at Fort McPherson, the movies that came out of Fort McPherson last year, not 2018, 17 and 18, when they first got going, they did $9 billion worth of movies. And there were some 32,000 people employed, I heard. That's real growth and opportunity. The airport was, when I first came here, the airport was a Quonset hut with one runway. In 2019, we were the busiest airport in the world and have been for some time now. We had 109 or 10 million passengers come through there. But it generates over $1 billion a year in jobs and income for the community. And half of the businesses out there are owned by minorities and female-owned companies. So what we've been able to do is work together and make things happen. The Olympics was another event that happened to be the biggest Olympics ever held in the history of the Olympics, 100 years old. But our Olympics was bigger than China's or Russia's or Japan or Paris. And we didn't use any government money. We built it with tax-exempt municipal bonds. We raised $2.5 billion and had almost $100 million left over. And everything we built, we gave to the people who owned the land we built it on.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so we started with nothing in 1988, and we ended with nothing in 1998. But we put on the biggest Olympics in history, you know, without a lot of effort because we were all working together.
Again, Ambassador Young, you know I could talk to you all night, all day. Thank you for this conversation. Every time I talk with you, I learn something new about the movement and something new about our people. And I thank you so much.
Well, it's pretty much all I've done most of my life. So, and I've been blessed with the pretty good memory. So I'm glad to share it.
I'm glad you are here to
share it. I'm glad that you're willing to listen.
I will always listen.
WCLK's The Local Take is produced by Kiplin Primus, Jami Wellman, and Rob Maynard for WCLK. Thanks to Mark Angel for our Local Take original music. You can listen to this program and past programs on demand at WCLK.com or via the WCLK app. If you have comments about today's program or suggestions for future programs, you can leave a voicemail at 404-880-6211 or email kiplinprimus@gmail.com. Thanks for listening to The Local Take, community engagement from Jazz 91.9 WCLK.